I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I always ask that of all my prayer. I just like the sound.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Apple baby mammy. Fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1989, shivering in the back of a blue Chevy Malibu here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
And I'm Philisco.
And with us again, LeVac is back! Told you I would get it right. Chandler is back. Chandler is back. Thank you so much for coming back on our show.
Oh my God, I'm so honored. This is such a treat.
I gotta say, Chandler, you've come on for some real bangers. You've come on for some like episodes that like I feel like last night, I don't know if you've listened to our 52 in review, but Kenny basically lauded last night with all of his awards this year. Understandably so, because it's a great movie. But also just, you know, Guinevere, which was a movie that like a little scene movie that I think we really loved. And obviously we want to have you back. You are one of the biggest Cameron Crowe fans I know. So it felt like we got to hear your thoughts on his first movie and some might argue his best movie.
I have such warm feelings about Chandler because I've only met her twice on these two podcasts, but we discussed two movies that I love, two movies I never even heard of before the podcast. So Chandler, I also have strong feelings for you otherwise. You're a very lovely person.
Thank you.
But only positive vibes. And I mean, that'll continue, you know, there's no beating around the bush. We did our top five 89 before this, and this was on my top five of the year. This is one of my favorite movies ever made.
It's so good.
Rewatched, nothing changed. Maybe even feel stronger about it.
Yeah.
There's just something about this film.
It's a work of art. It's like the warmest, you know, most unconventional teen movie. And
it's also like, I kind of want to unpack what is special about Cameron Crowe and like what it is about his voice that when it's working, and you know, we'll talk about our favorites of his at the end of the episode, but when it's not working, it's just kind of all off, right? But when it is working, there's really kind of no one I can think of that is so perfectly earnest and genuine and just, you know what I mean? Like hard on your sleeve in a way that isn't treacly and just really beautiful. Like this film to me, immediately, I was just like, these people just feel like real people in the best possible way. There's an intangibility to him that I think, you know, he's, you know, struggled finding perhaps over the last little bit with some of his films, but I don't know. There's just something really, really just lightning in a bottle with him. And this film is the beginning of that.
What a formidable like debut also as a writer and a director, you know, and it was like, I think Laszlo Kovacs is the cinematographer, which is crazy. Because Polly Platt like campaigned for him to shoot it. She was the producer on this movie. Just the performances that he gets, but it's like instantly, like it's his tone, like his universe. It's such an assured debut.
There's just, it doesn't feel like there's a camera there. And I know that you see that a lot. We've watched a lot of movies on this podcast, Kenny, but there's something about what he's able to capture. Part of it's in the words, obviously. I mean, there is a very sort of poetic way to the way he writes. We all wish that we sounded just this good in real life. Like it's just heightened enough that you wish that you had the vocabulary that these characters have, but at the same time, it feels believable. You know, it's really something. And you know, obviously Cameron Crowe prior to this writes Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which I watched relatively recently because I bought the Criterion of it. And I mean, also a staggeringly great movie. He just understands youthful voices, even today, I would argue, in a way that doesn't feel like an old guy. Do you know what I'm saying? Like he can, and I don't know if it's because he went undercover as a kid for so long for Fast Times and for Almost Famous and what have you in his actual life, but he just understands how kids think.
I mean, first of all, thrilled to be doing a Cameron Crowe movie. He didn't make a movie in 99.
He did not.
We have a plan to kind of backdoor a movie in there a little bit, but but he didn't do a movie in 99, so we haven't had the opportunity to talk about Cameron Crowe. And Cameron Crowe, for people our age, or at least for me and everyone I've ever met, is one of those kind of cornerstone filmmakers that made us all want to do it. Yeah. You know, I mean, to me, it's Cameron Crowe, Paul Thomas Anderson, kind of a Spike Jonze, Charlie Kaufman hybrid. And then, you know, someone else. I mean, who knows? For me, it's probably fucking Michael Bay. But,
throw a twist in there.
No, I don't know who the fourth would be for me, but he's a fundamental part of our kind of youth and understanding. And it's interesting because he really only made four great films. So four great films and Elizabethtown film. So that's interesting to me. Cameron Crowe's story is interesting too, because if you've seen Almost Famous, you know his story, which is like what he is. He graduated college at 15. He worked for Ben Fong Torres. He followed around the Allman Brothers band. He really wrote, you know, he wrote cover stories in Rolling Stone, but he had this truncated youth. The fact that he writes youth so well is weird because he didn't live like a kid. You know, and I don't know if that reporter's eye, that journalist's eye / ear is what contributed to this kind of, you know, really, you know, wholesale understanding of youth culture, but he has it in a way that most people don't have. Now, the one thing I want to say about Say Anything and kind of Cameron Crowe in general is, he obviously didn't direct Fast Times. Fast Times is a quintessential 80s movie. It feels like the 80s in every way. The shaggy dogness, the looseness of the plot,
the go-go's.
You know, the Go-Go's, yes, the mall, the, you know, everything, the Phoebe Cates, everything about it's very 80s. And then Singles is such a 90s movie, and Jerry Maguire is such a 90s movie. Say Anything doesn't feel like an 80s movie. Say Anything feels to me like a 70s movie, about people who live in the 80s. Like, when you from the score to the way it's shot to the way these characters talk to each other to the long takes to the long scenes to the, you know, kind of the focus on these two people, it is it to the lack of overt, you know, objectifying of women and or the, you know, the, all those Revenge of the Nerd qualities that make like so many films of those of that era like kind of too gross to even talk about anymore. It's a weird humanistic movie that you just didn't see that much in the 80s, particularly about young people. And I thought that was that might have been what I was what always struck me correctly about this movie, would always hit me in the right place. Whereas most 80s movies, you know, with the exception of like, I love some John Hughes movies, but most 80s movies about kids feel wrong to me.
Well, there's something also feels
exactly right.
Cameron Crowe is also one of those guys who understands when to use pop culture references and when not to. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he sort of can kind of read what makes sense and what doesn't. And this film is pretty devoid of those references, short of like, you know, Lloyd's Clash t-shirts or him showing Cocoon to the people at the retirement home.
Timeless.
I love that scene so much.
Timeless.
Cocoon.
Lloyd presents Cocoon. Yeah, it's
you know what the biggest dated reference in this movie is by a million? Kickboxing Sport of the Future.
Sure.
But that that's the funniest thing to me. I mean, for like a brief moment in time.
Totally.
Kickboxing was the sport of the future.
I like when he's like, dissed in the Malibu. Man, that's
just in the Malibu. Yeah. Yeah. Does he say something like that's your domain or that's your something like that? Yeah, it's not like a particularly dated movie in that way. It almost feels frozen, to your point, Kenny, in sort of this amber of not having a ton of things that date it in 88, 89, outside of the chicken that's wearing 88 before he gets torn apart at that party. But like things like that, you know what I mean? It's not particularly, it's kind of timeless in a beautiful way.
Yeah. And it's kind of an amazing reversal too of this really ambitious, brilliant young woman. And the fact that it's actually kind of like this love triangle between a daughter, her father, and her, you know, prospective boyfriend. It's like, and I still feel like it's one of the most original teen movie screenplays like ever written, and the kind of nuance and affection he has for the characters and how they're all complicated and multifaceted. Like even Diane Cord, who is sort of ostensibly like this perfect, like too good to be true woman. She still has a lot of like flaws and difficulties in her life. And she is like a fully fleshed out character in a way that a lot of times the like teen girl object of affection in a teen movie isn't, never gets allowed to be.
Well, she's also, I love her insecurity as well. Do you know, like, or her insecurities, the way they kind of ebb and flow throughout the film, you know, and the pressure that she feels to perform and to be this, you know,
so true.
What her father wants her to be. It's very interesting.
Or even just the way that she speaks to Lloyd, where she's like, I've never gone out with someone as basic as you.
That was forward thinking.
Sure. Even just the air quotes on I love you. We're just like, oh, it's like stuff like that where every now and then she shows not her true colors, that's the wrong way of putting it, but the influences of the people in her life and how they sort of manifest in her. It's interesting.
I don't even know how you pitch this movie. Even know. Like this is such a trust me movie, right? Like, it's about a guy and a girl, and the girl has some issues at home with their dad, but they're not like your typical alcoholic father issues. Like, they're really supportive, and I just don't know how you I just feel at the end of the pitch is just you gotta trust me. I'm gonna make it good because there's no way.
I think he wrote something else, like another script entirely. Yes. And then James L. Brooks was like, don't, you know, try writing something else. And then somehow this came out of him. And the character of Lloyd was actually modeled on this real guy that Cameron Crowe knew that was like an aspiring kickboxer and this kind of like strange dude. Because you're right. It's like yeah, I want to do it. And the dad's kind of like embezzling money from the old folks' home that he runs. And like, there's all these like very specific details that are so strange, but like really, really work.
That well, also like, yes, there's, it's hard to like this is the curse of Cameron Crowe. Just like this is the Cameron Crowe, this is the Charlie Kaufman thing where people think that they could do what those guys do. You know, but you can't deceptively do what he does.
Simple.
It's like I don't know how to say this in as the compliment I mean it.
Okay.
But I so Chandler, as you're saying, all right, the dad is embezzling money from the old age home. That is so specific.
Yeah.
And it also has no symbolic meaning other than what it means within the context of the movie. Like it's a weird thing to say, but the guts to have something just be what it is instead of being something metatextual or something subtextual and have it like just feel right. It's a weird fucking thing. It's a weird subplot in this movie and have it not feel like a weird, like, you know, third arm, or have it not feel like it's supposed to actually be a metaphor for his, you know, destroyed marriage. It's none of that. Her dad has his own life, his own issues, his own interiority, his own wants and his own desires. And he's given, you know, he's allowed through the full gamut of emotions, and he lives through his daughter, but only to a point. And it's the you said how much he loves his characters, the way he gives them dimensionality, all three of these characters, not to mention like even like Lily Tomlin. I'm sorry, Lily Taylor's character, you know, is so like self-absorbed in a way I almost like am shocked to see in a movie, to have like another character, but she's self-absorbed like to the point she's getting over a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
And it is a wild fucking movie.
It's
to like the worst guy of all time. And
Joe.
And I love Joe so much.
Joe.
And I don't know, but she's still an amazing, like, supportive friend at the same time. I know. Wild. I was thinking about that scene the other day where he's buying that luggage for his daughter and his credit card gets declined. And he's hitting on the woman at
the cashier. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're kind of flirting, and that other guy in the background goes,
that's
like
the key to that scene. It's the two moments he has with the other guy where the guy's like, go for it, man. And then when the credit card gets declined, the guy won't look him in the eyes anymore.
Yes.
I mean, it's a brutal scene. It's an amazing scene.
It's such an amazingly written scene. And in no other teen movie ever made would you include that scene. Like, it's just the nuance and specificity of this film like blows me away. And I think that's what makes it like actually timeless, is it's like deep idiosyncratic weirdness.
I think that just to piggyback and rewind a little bit to what you were saying earlier, I really do think the James L. Brooks thing is something worth underlying for a second.
Yes.
Because James L. Brooks, first and foremost, produces this film, which is an enormous deal. And he obviously is playing interference for Cameron Crowe to kind of be able to do a little bit of what he wants. It's a $16 million budget, which isn't nothing. But it's not, obviously a ton of money. But there is definitely a connection between James L. Brooks and Cameron Crowe, right? In terms of the way that they write, there is a very sort of idiosyncratic, very sort of lo-fi, you know, character-oriented movies, which is, I think, part of the reason why I think Cameron Crowe perhaps struggles right now, is that those type of films are incredibly hard to get made. And on top of that, because of the success that a Cameron Crowe or a James Earl Brooks or even a Judd Apatow has had, it means that their budgets are exceedingly high considering what's actually going on in these films. So you're in these sort of weird kind of slipstream of what that means. But all that being said, I think that the James Earl Brooks thing is really interesting because he doesn't produce singles, but he does produce Jerry Maguire. And that obviously is a gigantic success. But it's just interesting that this is sort of the first film and it doesn't really set the world on fire. Cameron Crowe credits Siskel and Ebert in a lot of ways for making this film have any success at the box office, quite frankly. It basically made its money back in a little bit, but it was never a huge success. But I believe Ebert put it on his top 10 list of 89, if I'm not mistaken, and was just a really big proponent of Cameron Crowe, understandably so. But it is interesting that, you know, Singles is the follow-up to this, and Singles is known basically for its soundtrack. I mean, that soundtrack was enormously successful, but the film itself was not particularly. I also think that, you know, you guys were talking about, you know, could a movie like this get made today, do you think? I mean, I maybe not at this budget, but
easily. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, not this is, yes, but like you said, not at this budget. This is,
sure.
This is, I feel like this movie's made 30 times a year.
I feel like it's programmed at Sundance like three or four times. Not to its, you know, not to this level of, success and humanity and stuff, but like The Spectacular Now, I don't know if you saw that film.
That's a good one.
That's definitely James Ponsold trying to do his Say Anything, and like Miles Teller really is evoking like a young Cusack in that film.
I just think it's so, just to, you know, obviously for a little bit of context, because I think it's worth talking about where this movie comes out and what it's coming out against. But basically, the film is a charming, critically acclaimed tale of first love. Lloyd, played by John Cusack, is an eternal optimist, seeks to capture the heart of Diane, an unattainable high school beauty and straight A student. It surprises just about everyone when she returns the sentiment, but Diane's overly possessive divorced father, played by John Mahoney, doesn't approve, and it will take more than the power of love to conquer all. Say Anything opened on April 14th, 1989, in third place behind Major League The Dream Team, was in second place. It would go on to make $21.5 million on a $60 million budget. It's got 98% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 85% from audiences. Roger Ebert's 4-star review says that Say Anything depends above all on the human qualities of its actors. Cusack and Sky must have been cast with their clear-eyed frankness, but their ability to embody burning intensity of young idealism. A movie like this is possible because its maker believes in the young characters and in doing the right thing and in staying true to oneself. The sad teenage comedies of recent years have apparently made by filmmakers who have little respect for themselves or their characters and sneer because they dare not dream. Which I think is interesting. I do sort of want to talk about what you were talking about a little bit, Kenny, in terms of like 80s rom-coms. I feel like this movie is, because of the age of these characters, they're graduating high school, so they're in theory on their way to college. Your rom-coms of the 80s tended to be a little bit more about straight up adults, right? You're When Harry Met Sally's of the world. And then your teen comedies tended to be more in the vein of, you know, a John Hughes movie or an Animal House or something like that. So this movie is sort of neither fish nor fowl, I think, is part of why it's special, but also why it probably didn't connect.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I like buy the premise that it didn't connect. Like, I think this movie's iconic. You know, and I think it was.
I meant more in the sense of, yes, it's obviously iconic now. I think in the moment it had its fans, but I think at that time I can understand why this movie was not a John Hughes-esque success, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Sure. I guess I'm rejecting the premise only because I just don't understand. I have a hard time viewing this movie as not a success. Considering, sure. I think it did pretty well at the box office and did very well with critics and birthed Cameron Crowe's career. And I think to me at least, I know I'm completely, you know, inverting your question, but to me, I think it did connect because this is true for When Harry Met Sally or any great romantic comedy. The romance has to be first.
Yeah.
First. And anything that's not serving that romance, you know, is wasted energy. Yeah. I can't think of an actual romantic comedy I like that isn't like, you know, the romance isn't the center of that film, up to and including, you know, there's Something About Mary. So, sure. You know, which like the ending of that movie to me is so fucking powerful. I immediately was like, I can't wait to see the Farrelly brothers do a straight romantic comedy.
And then
they did Fever Pitch.
So, I rewatched, you know, When Harry Met Sally recently. It was on HBO or something like that. And I, first of all, I forgot how great that movie is, but how insane that movie is. But the ending...
When Harry met Sally?
Sorry, no. Something about Mary. The end of it with Ben Stiller crying as he's walking, it's so incredible.
Good. And he's like, what about Brett Favre?
But also, they fuck with you because she's like, you forgot your keys. And he's like,
oh, yeah.
Well, she's like,
I'm a Niners fan.
Yeah.
It's such a shame to me that Peter Farrelly is now synonymous with, you know, the racist Oscar winner movie. Because he could have been the guy who directed like two of my favorite fucking movies ever made.
Yep.
And I think there's something about Mary is brilliant. I think the end of it is her, she's fucking with that's half of her character. I'm fucking with you. Yeah. So that's a beautiful callback. Him crying at the end. You never see that in a movie.
It's the fucking best.
You never see that.
I mean, watching it again, I was just like, she is a movie star. Like, you're watching that performance. Cameron Diaz in that movie is just shockingly just... How she didn't just take over the world.
Well, she did.
She was almost too good.
Yeah. Like, she was almost too good in that film that I think filmmakers were like, let's try everything. The thing that kind of fucked her up, now we're real far afield, was...
Yeah, this is Ron Cameron.
Yeah. Although they do work together later. So
yeah, Vanilla Sky.
Was the sweetest thing. The sweetest thing was where that movie's awful.
She also got paid a shit ton for Sweetest Thing. It was right after Charlie's Angels, and everyone was like, "She's the next big thing," and they just backed up a Brinks truck to her for that movie. And that movie sucks.
It's so scatological. It's kind of this female gross comedy, and it's like them trying to be like, "What if we took a Fairly Brothers movie, but we made it with like women and
what? Yeah,
right.
What
right,
if
right.
we found? What if we stumbled upon the female Jim Carrey?" It's such a weird idea. And I'm not trying to say she can't do it. I mean, she acted a scene with semen in her hair. Like, she did spectacular
and killed it. You know, she's great, spectacular.
But that movie was not the one.
I want to just back off to say anything for a second here, because I was reading up on the casting, because this is about the Ione Sky, Diane Court character. Mm. So apparently it came down to Ione Sky and Jennifer Connelly, which I do think is interesting.
That's like two shades of the same coin.
It's a little bit, right? Like, I could see Jennifer Connelly being quite good in this.
Yeah.
And she has that, obviously she's beautiful and what have you. I think part of why Ione Sky works, though, is because there's kind of no baggage there, right? Like, she had done a couple roles, but like, this was really her first leading role in a movie. And that unknown factor, I think, goes a long way. I think that Jennifer Connelly and John Cusack are kind of at the same level of fame, I would say, maybe, at that time.
Right. Yes. Well, I guess you'd be thinking of her like in Labyrinth or something, or what would be the...
Labyrinth is really the one.
Wait, when was Career Opportunities? Was that
after
not,
this?
Oh, was it after
that? Was
this?
90. But it's, you know what it is for me? All right. So I read that too. And immediately the first, because Jennifer Connelly's one of my favorites. And immediately I thought she would have been great.
Yeah.
And then I kind of took a half a step back, and I guess it was maybe during the movie I read that, or maybe right before I watched the movie, mm-hmm. and something would have been lost. Something would have been lost, because Jennifer Connelly, for all of her many talents, is not someone who I necessarily buy as deeply wounded. Which I think and as lacking in some way.
Yes.
Like, there was a big thing with Ione Sky here that felt like she was pushed by her dad, and I believe she also pushed herself to excel, to fulfill her potential, is how I think it was felt like she was the smartest kid in the school who also worked the hardest and therefore was one of the smartest kids in the country. Right. And
she had to choose between her parents, and she chose her dad. Right. So that's sort of like,
so she was in the game. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had agency. I don't think there's an issue with that, but she played this like I missed high school thing, you know, the Booksmart thing, yes. Right? Yes. I miss high school thing in a way that I never would ever buy from Jennifer Connelly.
Well, that was what I was going to say is I think there's two things. The first is, and I say this with all due respect, but Jennifer Connelly is too beautiful in a weird way. Like she does not seem of this earth. Like if you put her in these weird kind of old people frumpy clothes that Diane wears in this movie, which I love, by the way. But like, I guess I don't know that I could buy Jennifer Connelly as a sort of broken weirdo nerd kind of thing that there is inside Diane Court.
Whereas I think it's like she, what do they say? She's a brain game, trapped game in the body of a game show host.
I keep trying to deal with that thing too. And like, if Jennifer, like, here's the, like,
by the way, I haven't rewatched this. I just know every single line from this. embedded in my cortex. Like,
it's like, Jennifer, guard. So Ione Sky comes out to go to that party.
The shawl and the like Tahitian flower in her hair.
Yes.
Those weird strappy pumps, and she kind of descends down the stairs.
Yep.
True. She doesn't. She doesn't.
She That's walks the from thing the kitchen.
I was going to say. She walks from the kitchen. Sorry. So she doesn't descend down the stairs with Kiss Me playing because it's not fucking She's All That is about giving Freddie Prinze Jr. his fucking trophy in the moment.
Sure.
And that's how that moment is supposed to feel for him. That's not how this feels. And I don't know how Jennifer Connelly walks out in that same dress without doves also flying behind her. It's just, there's
that's
just
what I mean.
Some, yeah. No, I know what I you're know. Saying. I'm and sure. I'm hesitant to boil this all down to their looks. Because Ione Sky is gorgeous, and that's a big part of this character, is that I think she was viewed by the school as like, don't even bother because she won't like return your calls because she doesn't even like acknowledge that there's a social system in the school.
But I think that Ione Sky is beautiful. I'm not saying she's not, but she's beautiful in a terrestrial way. Like, she seems like the type of beautiful girl that would be at your high school. She seems like an actual person. That's not to take away from her beauty. Jennifer Connelly, and maybe it's because of all the years of things that I've seen her in, but it's hard to say. The other person that was considered apparently was Elizabeth Shue, which I also think would have been wrong.
Yeah.
But interesting, but I understand why she was in the conversation. Hmm. There's something about Diane Court.
Because she was the fucking best.
Right, she's awesome.
Because she, in this period, she made Cocktail work. She's the best. and actually, like, so that's interesting too, an interesting piece of casting, because Jennifer Connelly is almost like Ersatz Ione Sky, right?
Yes.
And like Chandler said, two shades of the same color. And like, Elizabeth Shue's a completely different movie.
Completely different.
Yeah. And I would have also loved that version.
I'm sure she
could have played every beat of that too. But
I feel like there's nobody more feminine than Diane Court, like in this movie. Like when she's serving all of those elderly people at the like their tea in the cafeteria, and the way that she dressed, she just like has this like unfeminine. She has this femininity that Lloyd Dobler's friends don't have. Like she's like the contrast between his friends, which also include
Pamela Adlon.
Yeah, Pamela Adlon.
For like, a scene, yeah.
Yeah, it's just so wild.
She looks so young. It's crazy. It's like crazy. Yeah. But I agree with you, Chandler. There's something very tomboyish about the girls that Lloyd hangs out with. He even says it at one point. He's like, I gotta hang out with more guys. I hang out with too many girls. And then the guys are just like fucking at the, you know.
Even Joan Cusack feels like a different kind of woman than Diane. Diane Court's like a lady or something.
For sure. I mean, the look on his face when she walks out in that dress, Kenny, when he's like, oh, like he's just like, I am punching way above my
And then, and the fact that the dad is treating him like that too.
Well, just that doesn't like, help. Yeah.
You don't
yeah.
deserve to be here, you know.
I love the phone call to the dad. Well, not to the dad. Yeah. But when the dad picks up the phone call and the dad just asks him about all the different cars. Are you the guy that drives the Mustang? Are you the guy that drives the Datsun? Are you the guy that drives the truck? Yeah. I think that's great. I want to talk for a second about the casting of John Cusack. There were a couple other people, none of which I think make any fucking sense for this role, but it's also so iconically John Cusack now that it's impossible to really consider anyone else. Christian Slater, Lauren Dean, who played Joe, auditioned for Lloyd.
Really?
Pete Berg, Todd Field, Robert Downey Jr., Kirk Cameron? Yeah.
Oh my God.
Could you imagine a world where Kirk Cameron got the big roles in the 80s and didn't feel like so rejected by Hollywood that he had to become what he became?
Yeah, he doesn't have to create the second apocalypse.
But I mean, I look at this list and it's like, I mean, sure, maybe there's a world where a Robert Downey Jr. could be Lloyd Dobler. I don't know. I don't want that.
All right.
He would be good at like the fast talking kind of cadence of the character. Right, but that would be like literally it. Like he'd be good at delivering the long monologues about like, I don't want to buy, sell anything that's processed or processed.
I could see him also playing the Eric Stoltz character.
Oh, 100%. There, you know what? I was going to say Robert Downey Jr. has never been a convincing romantic lead except he has been. In Iron Man.
I thought you were going to say chances are.
No, he was so unconvincing in that.
I thought you were going to say kiss, kiss, bang, bang.
Yes. Hetero romantically. But in Iron Man, I really do long for those two to get together.
Gwyneth, off the charts.
So he has it in, but a lot of that is his, you know, grown man energy in that. Because
Allie McBeal. He's great in Allie McBeal.
Also, but where I also think he has grown man energy.
Gotcha.
As a boy, he had, to me at least, like, I don't want you at this party energy. You know?
Less than zero.
Less than zero is exactly what I'm thinking of. Yes.
Did you guys ever see The Sure Thing, the Rob Reiner romantic comedy that Cusack is in?
That's
in
like 1985. That's the only early Rob Reiner film that isn't like a super classic.
It's really good.
I've never seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, people love it. It was number one Screen Draft's road trip.
Really?
List. Yeah.
That's insane. Wow.
Yeah. Well, how do I know? I've never seen it.
So you, Kenny, said that of that list, there was someone that you thought.
Oh, of that list? No, I don't think anyone would be great. But who's the first person you said? The first person
Christian
said
Slater, Lauren Dean, Pete Berg.
Oh, Todd I would Field. Hate to watch this movie with Christian Slater.
All right,
I can't get like Heathers out of my head. Yeah, like, totally. Or,
I think... You know, I don't think anyone would be great. I think it's Cusack's movie. Cusack was a very specific guy at that point.
Totally.
And he's, you know, it's interesting. As he's gotten older, he's gotten less and less leading man-ish, right?
Yes.
And less and he's played kind of off the leading man over and over again and a little brainier. And even in like Gross Point Blank, he was kind of like done with that leading man thing.
Totally.
He was already playing kind of dark and quirky, same with High Fidelity. But here he was like, it made sense. Like everything about his like confidence, because you had to have like this like go fuck it confidence to pull it off. Sure. It really, really worked. And I think like, I don't know. There are like more modern actors who could have played this. Like this is to me the archetype for a lot of what younger actors are doing today.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Jesse Eisenberg you know, Michael Cera or
totally.
Tons
I would even
of,
go
I
as
feel
far
like
as
Todd
say,
Holland
like,
or Tom Holland.
There's a lot of these guys who are playing who just come at it with this nice guy confidence. You know, which I love. And I don't think like, you know, a lot of actors even kind of knew that was a thing.
A road.
To play.
It's just the sincerity, though. It's like that. I always think when I first time I watched this in high school, the line where his friends are warning him not to go out with Diane Court because he's going to get hurt. And he says, I want to get hurt. You know?
Oh, I love that line.
It's such a good line. And it's exactly how I felt in high school. Like we're just waiting for somebody to follow.
Me too, Chandler. I remember that. I remember saying to one of my friends who like gotten broken up with, because I was so like dead inside, something like, at least you're feeling something. You know, doesn't it feel good?
Fight
to
Club
feel
all over
something?
Again. You want to get in the fight to feel something.
And I would say this part is like the part that, you know, both launches John Cusack but defines him as an actor forever. And every role he's had, you know, he's either tried to like play against this performance or, you know,
well, that brings
it.
Me
it's
to
like,
my
High Fidelity, like, literally takes, you know, shots from this movie and recontextualizes them when he's crying on the phone outside of, you know, her apartment and stuff.
Is this his best performance?
Yes.
It feels like it, right? Like, it's unfortunate that, like, right out of the gate, he gives us his best, but, like, it's kind of his best, right?
Well, I think it's because the director just knows, like, they feel like they're so aesthetically aligned. Like he's like his, you know, soulmate as a, you know, like, I don't know if there is a better pairing of a director and an actor than this, or there's something about, I think, certain directors, they find someone who sort of synthesizes who they are as a person. Like, it's almost like Cameron Crowe's soul is in John Cusack's body.
So it becomes his avatar, essentially.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, I look at, like, because Kenny and I, we talked a little bit about Con Air when we did that.
That's an interesting.
He's actually, he does Gross Point Blank and Con Air right back to back. And there was this moment there where he showed another gear of, like, you know, that there's a little bit of snark, there's a little bit of edge to him, and that he could show that side. But he never fully capitalizes on it, I feel like. I mean, Gross Point Blank and Con Air are the closest he gets to it.
Yeah, and then there's, like, anomalies like Identity or Serendipity or something.
And, like, Pushing Tin, we talked about, obviously, in 99.
Yeah, he...
Cradle of Rock. Being John Malkovich, obviously.
Oh, my God. That's a really interesting Cusack.
That's him doing something completely different.
That's his best performance.
That's such a good performance.
But what's weird about that performance is it didn't even enter my fucking mind. And it's one of my favorite movies. And I didn't even think about it. Or with Cameron Diaz.
I never think of him in it either.
Think about it. I know. I didn't. So it's,
I do think about Catherine Keener in that movie all the time.
Sure. All the time. He was incredible in that film. He was so the one who gave birth to my love of meanies. he was incredible in Being John Malkovich. That is his best role. You know what I was going to say, and this plays into this too. He's
playing a Lord Dobler in that movie, just an evil Lord Dobler.
A
puppeteer,
an older, sadder. Has totally lost his way. Lost,
like,
Lloyd
if he
Dobler
kidnapped and, Diane Court, and somehow she was forced to raise orangutans.
It kind of seems like somewhere in the early 90s, he's like, I like what Nicolas Cage is doing.
Yes.
I think I can do that.
Yes.
And I think that is a path that I can go down. And so he started to do these, you know, like dark Nicolas Cage films. Being John Malkovich is obviously like kind of a wild Nicolas Cage film. And he didn't quite get there, but I think he got pretty close. Mm-hmm. You know, like he definitely like, he was never an embarrassment. He was never an embarrassing kind of figure. Even today, he's not really an embarrassing figure.
Some of his political beliefs are questionable, but yeah.
What are his political beliefs? I thought
his Twitter feed is bonkers.
I thought he's a good political guy.
He's not, just to be clear, he's not like a fucking Trumper or anything like that, but there's a lot of, like, weird mixed messages coming from him.
Yeah, all right. Well, you know, he's had a lot.
None of us are perfect. But anyway.
but Lloyd Dobler is one of the great romantics in
100%. You
know, film history. And I think the fact that he just loves and worships Diane Court and just wants to make her, he wants to be of value to her. Mm-hmm. You know, he's looking for a dare to be great situation.
Yeah,
it's true.
Like, I want to ask you guys.
There's no men in movies like that. Even in romantic comedies, men don't rise up to that kind of occasion and sort of venerate, you know, women and their ambitions. Like, there's literally no movie that does that. And I think that's why this movie, like, has the eternal life that it has, because it is so sincerely selfless and romantic.
Well, it's like what Corey says to him, like, be a man. There are so many guys. Be a man.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what's so cool about this film.
Yeah.
Yes, be a man. His conclusion is, what I want to do with my wife, of my life, is support my girlfriend or support my future wife or support my woman, right? Support, I want to be, that is what I'm good at. She is on a rocket ship and she's going to need someone who is there helping her. Clearly, she has, you know, she has some emotional neediness that she's put off on her dad for a long time, but he thinks he can do a better job. And she's always needed someone to be there to, you know, help her rise to the top. What's remarkable about this, and the reason no one ever talks about this movie in a bad light, I'm talking about, like, assholes, like assholes.
Sure.
This movie, is because he manages to do that without sacrificing 1 ounce of masculinity. And
yes,
that is the Cameron Crowe genius. Yep, yep, it's yep, this yep. genius of like, and it's not, there is no big decision. There's no deliberation. Well, if I support my girlfriend, does that make me less of a man? There is none of that. It is just, he's a guy who likes kickboxing and he likes being there for his girlfriend. And yes. he is a man in every single fucking sense of the word that we want to believe a man is. And it's just, it's so cool. There's no fucking Mr. Mom-esque shaming of being there for your team. Yeah.
Well, so, I would say
you're right. I didn't think about how revolutionary that is. That he
does it again with Jerry Maguire too, right?
It's true.
He takes this alpha male, Tom Cruise, the most like, you know, I don't know, whatever you want to call him at the time, but like, you know, he was a man's man. He makes him into this. Emotional. It's like he goes through this whole emotional journey of becoming essentially a real human being.
Yeah, I mean, the climax of the movie is him entering that women's group, and he's I'm looking for my wife.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, let's show in that movie.
I do think that he still knows that he's not complete without her, and that there's something that he needs in his life that she affords.
Yeah, but that's not so revolutionary to me. No, I think that's a lot of romantic movies, the man realizing that, but I love Jerry Maguire. I just don't think it's quite as elevated as this movie in these terms. Like, I think the beauty of Jerry Maguire to me is someone who looks and acts like Tom Cruise and has the world by the short hairs, so to speak, recognizes that's not everything. And that's really hard. That's a really hard thing when you're a master of the universe to like kind of willingly like give it up and actually appreciate what's important. But it's not the same.
Jerry
Maguire
feels more like it's him trying to make a film in like the Billy Wilder tradition. Like it's more of a movie about America and like the meaning of success and sort of self-determinism. And that's part of, you know, a family structure in this sort of unconventional romance. But
It's also a big
say anything has like
swing.
A purity to it that it's like about first love and
yeah.
I mean, I think that Jerry Maguire is a unicorn for a myriad of reasons. But you know, I think that obviously once Tom Cruise attaches to a movie like that, it's going places and it's what it is. But I still think that film, and Kenny and I have talked about Jerry Maguire many times, and we both obviously very much love it. That movie is trying to do a million things and somehow it's able to stick basically most of them. Like it's a crazy amount of ideas that he's wrapped up in this what seems like a conventional romantic comedy.
Yeah, it's about sports, it's about capitalism,
it's like everything under the sun.
Yeah.
No one
American cravenness and like deception.
Marriage and like all of it. It's just like
family. You know.
Jerry
loyalty,
Maguire,
first and foremost.
Yeah, and you're all hitting on all the right things. Jerry Maguire, and no one will ever acknowledge this until, you know, right now, is a version of The Godfather. Like, that's like, it's that kind of storytelling. It's over the course of many years, and it's about grappling with what America has become and your place in America and and finding yourself through the people around you. Yeah. And it's so much closer to those epic films than it is to some movie about sports or anything else. Jerry Maguire is an epic is what I'm getting at. It has an epic scale and the fact that it has it's like a novel. It's like it has chapters and it's like David Copperfield. But
it's pretty crazy he was not nominated for Best Director for that film.
Yeah, even the cover looked like Catcher in the Rye. And it's like, it's just, there's just something about that movie in that moment that I love. And I think that movie is like so flawed in so many ways, but I love it. This movie is literally perfect in every way.
Which is so clean. It's just.
Yeah, the thing that I, all right, so last little thing that I love is when you watch if you were to tell someone about this movie, and you hadn't seen it in a while. You're not Chandler, and you don't remember everything about it. And you were telling someone about this movie. I literally remember
like her every cardigan she wears in the movie.
Oh, so good.
If you're
those are so weird.
Yes, if you don't have a Diane Court cardigan tumbler in your brain.
I literally remember like the choreography when they get in the car and he's
and they do the
teaching her how to drive and switch seats. Yeah. Oh my god.
So if you're trying to explain this movie to somebody, you would probably, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, say it's about a guy who falls in love with a girl, but everything would be centered on Lloyd's POV.
Yep.
When you watch the movie is really about Diane. Diane is the one who is making the decision. She is the one who is active. She is the one with the big conflict. She is the one who is dealing with the two other characters on an emotional level. That's have some interactions, but only with Diane, right? So the logical conclusion of that, this is why this movie's like a better than just a movie or romantic comedy is, all right, Cameron Crowe made the decision, and this is revolutionary, even though it shouldn't be, to treat both sides of this love team, this relationship equally, or maybe even give Diane a little more character development, but equally. If you're going to treat them equally, then they have an equal right to a happy ending. They have an equal right to all optionality in their life, right? Mm-hmm. So giving, and you also set Diane up as this, you know, genius who's on her way up, and Lloyd as this guy who's kind of, you know, lost in the storm, to then set this couple off on Diane's path together is the logical conclusion for anybody who actually cared about your own characters. But it's so revolutionary because almost always you go down the man's path in these movies. Mm-hmm. Almost always. Like even when Harry met Sally, which I love, they don't get together until fucking Harry decides it's time to get together. You know? Like until Harry's like, all right, New Year's, I'm ready, let's do it.
Yeah.
I would actually argue that it's kind of the opposite, though, like in Pretty in Pink or 16 Candles. Like you're kind of actually seeing it from the female, the female point of view and like the male love objects who are unattainable. And it's actually like the female character trying to like win and pursue those guys. Andrew McCarthy with like the flattest hair known to men.
Totally agree with you. I didn't mean to say that it was always the man's point of view. I meant to say that he gave these characters equal weight.
Yeah.
So sometimes you see it from the woman's point of view, and sometimes you see it from the man's point of view. Mm-hmm. But when you see it from a more even-handed point of view, and I think in almost all these films, you go off on the man's journey at the end. Sure. Now, like 16 Candles, I don't even think is a rom-com. She hardly even chills with Jake Ryan. And Pretty in Pink is weird because the ending of the movie is not the real ending of the movie. So
certainly there is no like scene as nuanced as like a loss of virginity scene where someone is like trembling and the girl's like
trying
the boy is trembling and the girl's like trying to like comfort
him. Just listen to the music.
Yeah. The amount of the sensual experience they've had is just so all encompassing that he's just like mowed down by vulnerability. Like, I don't know.
Could you guys imagine if he picked a bad song?
It wasn't supposed to be that song, as you very well know, I'm sure.
Yeah, what was it supposed to be? Right.
I forgot.
It was supposed to be some other song I'd never heard of before. And then they kind of stumbled upon In Your Eyes.
Yeah.
But I want to just talk very quickly about the John Mahoney casting for a quick second. Because
oh my God. So
apparently
good.
There was a moment when Dick Van Dyke expressed interest in playing the role, which would have been interesting. I don't know what that movie is, but it would have been interesting. Also, Cameron Crowe sent the script to Richard Dreyfuss. You're going to love this. Oh! This is the most Richard. Do you know this quote? Have you heard this
before? No, but I'm sure he started by saying, this is Richard Dreyfuss.
So Richard
Cameron,
Richard Dreyfuss read the script and sent a note back that said, great script, want to play Lloyd. Which, if that doesn't encapsulate everything
I hate this
about
dude
Richard
so
Dreyfuss.
Much.
Like, isn't that the worst?
He's the worst. And there's something about this guy that makes me want to fucking fight him. I want to play Lloyd Dobler.
Yeah, it's so ridiculous.
Of course he wanted to play Lloyd.
Of course he did.
He probably sent it to the dailies from Always.
Probably. Yeah, that was also 89. The other thing, do you remember, Kenny, a few years ago? I completely forgot about this until I was doing some reading about the show that they tried to make.
Yes, I do. I'm not quite so, over.
I don't know if you heard about this, Lloyd.
No,
yes, you might not.
I do.
But a few years ago, NBC greenlit a project through 20th. Aaron Kaplan produced it. Justin Adler wrote it, which was going to be a TV show based on Say Anything. But then when Cameron Crowe found out about it and didn't approve of the project, they killed the whole thing. Now, wow. Ken, let me ask you, would
Let's
you ever in a million
right
fucking
now.
Years try to make a thing, a Cameron Crowe thing, without getting Cameron Crowe's approval?
No, never. That's insane. And that's mean. And that's nasty. And they did the right thing when Cameron Crowe, because they didn't have to. They didn't have to kill it. That was the whole point.
I know.
But they did the right thing. But it was announced. This was a thing. Like someone really, really missed the ball. Constitutionally, I think this is a bad idea. Yes. But I would also, as a TV show, but I would also say some of the best movie to TV shows are the things that you'd never expect would make the TV shows, like Parenthood and About a Boy at that time, Friday Night Lights. So there is a, you give it to the right guy.
Yeah.
Now those were all Kadams. So you give it to Kadams.
Give it to Kadam.
he could probably figure it out.
Yeah.
And I like, what is Say Anything a TV show? Like, I don't really know. I guess it's just like the Wonder Years, just like a, you know, a good thoughtful show about high school.
But you works about just, them in
you
London.
Would just take,
them in England.
Oh, that's a good idea. You could, I mean, you could take the central events of this movie and just spread it out over, you know, a season of television.
Yeah, maybe. But NBC is looking for 22 of these things, so I don't know, man. I mean, but I just think it's a bad idea. But
I have a question.
No,
for you
don't
guys.
Mess with really perfect things.
Yes.
Speaking of bad ideas, if Cameron Crowe pitched this movie to you and then said, "And the main character's name is Lloyd Dobler." What would you guys say?
Yeah, I know.
He's a young, virile, handsome kickboxing man named Lloyd Dobler.
But that's what's so great about it. Like,
I couldn't agree more.
It is so perfect because it's so unassuming. It's so the essence of Lloyd. Like, you know, every other, you know, teen heroine in a movie of that time probably has names like Rick or like Jack.
Jake Ryan.
Jake Ryan, like the waspiest things. But Lloyd Dobler, I mean, he should be like an accountant,
That's a Moranis like, character.
It's like in the when they're in the car and he's asking her what people wrote in your yearbook, and he's like, "People wrote in mine, see you around, Lloyd, maybe." Like, which, and that's the response a Lloyd Dobler should get. Like, I think that's what makes it so special, right? I mean, I agree with you, Kenny. Like, that's
Lloyd
not a hero's name.
But Lloyd knows how to, I guess he's had like this crazy life where he's been kicking around and he was with his parents.
Yeah, he's an army brat.
Now he lives with Joan Cusack.
He lives with his sister, his real sister.
But now.
In the living room. That's where he sleeps with the giant wheat.
It's the best.
Lloyd.
But he understands how to navigate the system of high school. Like, he's not an anomaly. He fits in. He's cool in a way. Maybe he's cool with like sort of burnouts and Jeremy Piven types, but he's still like,
he is cool. He seems respected.
He fits into that party, you know?
Oh yeah. They love him at that party.
Yeah. You must chill. You must chill.
Your keys. I mean, there's also just, one of my favorite
teacher,
Bibi Newirth. She's amazing. Yeah, she's amazing.
Just
the coolest teacher
party?
Ever. Yeah, she's like hanging out at the party. She gives him her keys. It's crazy. I do think there's a couple, that party sequence, by the way, I mean, is amazing because of how real it feels. All those kids feel real.
But there's
that moment when some guy is just in the hallway and he goes, "Lloyd Dobler, all right."
Oh yeah, and he's like, "How'd you get Diane Court to go out with you?" He's like, "I just asked her." He's like, "All right,
you give me hope, man.
You give me hope with that guy with that hair. That maybe wasn't ridiculous at that moment." And that guy, they drive crazy home.
Yeah. The flock of seagulls.
You know that kid? That's Barbra Streisand's kid.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
What?
Oh.
Wow.
Another thing I love about this movie is fucking high school movies are always about where you fall in the social hierarchy.
Totally.
We're too low, or we're the kings, or we're in the middle, and like people know us, but not the cool people. This movie is not about that, which, like, I'm not trying to say that's not a thing. Obviously, it's a thing. Yeah. They've made 100 million movies about it. It really stays with people. But not every movie has to be about where you are on the social hierarchy. Mm-hmm. It's just like that's not the vibe I get from it at all. And that's not why she dates him. That's not why he dates her. And that's they don't go into this party, you know, high status. They don't go in low status. They just go in. It's just it takes you away from, you know what it takes you away from, which I really appreciate about this movie, from the feeling that their relationship is constantly being judged by everybody around them. Mm-hmm. And you feel that with almost every movie. Like, I mean, throw out anything, but like Clueless, which is a masterpiece. Ty is being judged because she wants to date Travis Birkenstock because he's a fucking burnout. Like, because he's a loser. Like, you can't date this fucking loser. You're trying to be cool. Like, it's just so exhausting to have every movie being about, like, stay in your fucking, you know, social lame strata.
Yeah. 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 Totally.
It's more of a class and, like, I don't know. It's the one high school movie where it's actually more about the potential you have for the future. Like, where you're going to fit in after high school, right? Mm-hmm. And like, she's not even really participating in high school because she's so ambitious and kind of already on to sort of what college, you know, she's already taking classes at colleges while she's in high school.
I do think that Lloyd is concerned about meeting Diane's standards to a certain degree. Like, I think there's times where
she's classy, not because she's cool.
Yeah. No, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think personally that the moment when Lloyd wins over Diane, because when he calls her, she immediately says, like, I'm busy.
Yeah.
And he says, so you're monumentally busy? It's the word choice.
Yes.
Because then you just think about her fucking dictionary, which I think about all the time with all the marks next to how she's marked all the words that she's looked up. I think him using that word wins her over and kind of goes like, I like that he used the word monument. Like, she smiles. And it's kind of, that's when the ball gets rolling a little bit and he has a chance with her.
And then he knocks that glass out of her way when she's walking.
Well, yes, of course. Yeah, watch out for the glass. Yeah.
The staging of, like, some of the scenes is so perfect. Like, when she's getting changed for that.
Behind the door with the dresses.
Yes. Yeah. And she's like, do you like this one? He's like, that's a nice dress too. And you can tell he's like so attracted to her, but trying to be respectful and knows that his parent. But it's just like, some of the blocking and the way that Cameron Crowe, like, films those scenes, like, it's very simple, but it's like so exactly how that would play out. Like, his way of working with actors is just, it's brilliant.
Well, and even you talk about blocking, but like, whenever Lloyd's on the phone and he's got that old phone and he's moving around and he's got the cord and he's like stepping in and out of the bathtub and like, he doesn't know what to do with his body. Like, it's great shit. Great.
And then it's like his, you know, nephew is coming in and out and like, you know, he's like, don't talk.
Yeah. That kid's face when Lloyd is leaving at the end. Like, what a little actor.
What an actor. A great delivery of what do we love?
Buy your own. Pain.
Have you guys ever had to write quote unquote, a great first date, like, and like fill it in. Like someone's like, I'll write a great first. They had a great first date. You'll write it. Have you ever had to?
I'm sure I've written that scene not well. Because
the idea is like, all right, they go on a great first date. The idea is always like, and this is why you see so many stupid fucking county fairs in movies. Because
because can get them on the Ferris wheel.
Ferris wheel, winning like shit for each other.
Yeah. Firing at like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like yeah, showing yeah. off their skills or like, yep. you know, wiping mm-hmm. fucking shit off each other's face. Because yep. there's all this stuff here and it's a fun first date without ever being a fun first date. Yep. But like the literal best fucking date I've ever been on with not my wife. Every date I've ever been on with my wife is the best date I've ever been on. The next best date. Well, it wasn't really a date. I just ran. Oh, yeah. It was all night, but it wasn't like we were in bed all night. We weren't in bed for one moment of it. Right. There's a girl I knew. We met at a party. We just like, we're like, you want to just keep hanging out? We walked through the city. We went to a diner. And when we finally left each other, it was light out. And nothing happened. Nope. Nothing happened except the night just didn't end. And that's what's so fucking cool about this movie.
Totally.
And also, if there's a save the cat moment for John Mahoney, it's him not getting mad when she shows up in the morning. That's that's when you're like, all right, so this isn't your typical asshole dad who's mm-hmm. just out to like ruin her life.
Totally. Like, and that scene, by the way.
But
that scene's great. The scene when she tells him about them having sex for the first time. Oh my God. Scene.
She's like, that's an unbelievable scene. I attacked him anyways. And
yeah.
He's like, and I know I can say anything to you. And it just feels so good to know that you won't judge me.
Yeah. There's so much in that scene. One of my favorite moments is when she's like, he had that look on his face. You know that look? And the dad's like,
oh, yeah. Well, it's just the fact that like, that
we
her
see
best
it later
friend,
in the luggage store.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Her best friend and her biggest confidant is her divorced dad. Like, it's such an interesting and sad dynamic. And I've never seen a movie about like a father-daughter relationship that sort of is like complicated and Freudian and nuanced as this. And then like that ending where he's in the prison yard and that's Lloyd great. Gives him the letter and they're deconstructing like her sentence structure. And just the fact that she had written you a letter like this, doesn't that mean that she had to think about it and she had to love you?
That it exists, isn't that enough?
And the reversal of him giving him back the pen is just
fantastic. It's a great callback.
What do you guys take? This is about me. Mm-hmm. What do you guys take from the past? I've seen this movie innumerable times. I didn't remember that she let him off the hook at the end. I never remembered that they hugged. Yeah. And my memory of the movie was John Cusack met with John Mahoney and John Mahoney was kind of a dick and he gave her the letter and it was like, don't you know, just the fact that she wrote that, it was left on this bittersweet note. I didn't remember that grace note they gave him at the end, which by the way, like, man, I'm happy they did it. Like having kind of both things within me, like having like the weird Mandela effect thing where it doesn't get resolved and the reality where it does get resolved. It's feels better with it feels more Diane Court to let him off the hook.
100% And it should be said too, like she lets him off the hook, but there's an ellipse there too, right? Like
big time.
The hug that he gives her she's a life raft and her arms are at her side and she's really not hugging him back.
She says, I love you back. She does. So like,
but you know what I mean? Like there's an iciness there and the fucking pen is a little bit of a jab. Right, like the pen is definitely a little bit of a.
But that's not her character. She's not jabbing him. That's for us. That's to show us that Lloyd is in the post position now, and Dad is number two.
Well, it's kind of like Lloyd become. There's a sort of battle for who's going to be her father and caretaker. Yes. Right. And Lloyd wins at the end, and it's like not only does he have to say goodbye to his daughter and give him up, it's like Lloyd's a better father to her than he can be right now. You know,
as a dad who has a relationship with his daughter that's not dissimilar from this, like I needed that dunk at the end. Like I need to know that I could fuck up like so horribly and my daughter will always be there for me, 100%. Which is weird. She's nine, but
but I agree with you, Kenny, that there's something. It's you know, one of the things about this movie that always stayed with me, because I saw it back in the day. I probably wasn't 89, but it was certainly in the early 90s, and I remembered liking it, and for all the reasons that we're talking about. But the turn, the IRS turn, right?
That's with Philip Baker Hall, such good
guess. Right, it's great. But like all of the stuff with the dad, all the criminal behavior of the dad always felt jarring to me for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then slowly but surely, as I got older, as I, you know, became a writer myself, it slowly but surely felt better. And I feel like this time watching it, it felt seamless to me. Like, I don't know if it's because of who I am now or whatever the case might be, but what you're saying is true, Kenny, which is the idea that this movie essentially ends in a prison yard really doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But it does. But you
have that beautiful last scene at the airplane.
We're going to talk about that scene. But I'm just saying that, like, in general, the fact that this film, for all intents and purposes, basically ends in a prison yard with a man incarcerated
white collar crimes. Never been anything like this. Like,
I think about one of the best scenes in the movie for me is the scene where they're in the kitchen. It's Diane and her father, and he's cooking, and there's some blocking stuff going on. But ultimately, it's Jim grappling with the guilt of what he's doing professionally. You can sense that it's getting away from him, and he's not sure how he's going to be able to get out of this. His daughter's leaving on top of everything. So he's losing arguably the most important person in his life, to which he's doing all sorts of criminal behavior to give the best, quote unquote, possible life she could have. And it's a really, like, Jim's character, I would argue, is the hardest character to land in this movie. Because the navigation of what's necessary,
there is
not just
no fucking
but
handbook
writing,
for this character,
right? They're just
you sort of see him as through Diane's eyes, and sort of at first he's this very venerated, sweet, warm character. You see him singing to Ricky, "Don't lose that number." I love that scene so
much. It's great.
And he's, you know, he's like a foe to Lloyd, but only because, you know, he loves his daughter so much. And then as she starts to put the pieces together more and more, and it's almost like the movie changes alliances towards Lloyd. Mm-hmm. And so then he becomes more and more like of an adversarial figure until he's like actually evil. Like he becomes like more and more toxic and aggressive towards her as like his desperation.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, the way he says, "I make their lives better."
Oh my god! Fucking intense. I think about that delivery of that line like all the time.
It's an because it's just he believes this in his bones.
Yeah,
that he's convinced himself
because he's
that
an incredible
what he's doing
actor.
Is totally fine. Yeah,
because he is just an incredible actor. It's, you know, it's interesting.
Did we lose Chandler here?
Yes.
I'm
still here.
You froze.
But you know, I think as a first time director. For Cameron Crowe, like you have to be an incredible director to also be able to, you know, communicate that to an actor and not have them play it too big and also able to go there into those more unlikable territories. Like you don't see him trying to protect that performance or make the character more palatable or less selfish or less antagonistic also.
I think, you know what, everything you're saying, I totally agree with. I think the character of Jim is, you know, incredibly unique. I think when you were running down the people who were in the running for him or wanted to play him or whatever. Sure. Yeah, I think at this time, John Mahoney was more or less a small-time film actor and big-time stage actor.
Yeah, big Chicago theater actor.
For sure. Yeah, right. So big theater
like
guy.
Like a Steppenwolf
guy. Yes. So he's like, you know, pro's pro and like he, you know, he... But he's certainly not any form of stunt casting. What I think is interesting, and going for like the A-plus actor's actor over, you know, someone who's a star at the time is an interesting choice to begin with. But the one that I'm really kind of coning in on is the idea of Dick Van Dyke. Because that feels like Dick Van Dyke saw Mary Tyler Moore did in Ordinary People.
Sure,
and somehow glean that maybe this could be his Oscar role. Now, why Ordinary People, a film that I truly love and think is weirdly underrated only because it'd be Raging Bull. but Ordinary People is a teen movie too. The protagonist in that movie is a teenager, and it's about a teen relationship, and it's about a teen getting over the death of his brother in a, you know, bad family situation. It's not that different from this movie. Why was that a Best Picture winning movie? And this is a movie that is beloved by us, but wasn't the kind of movie that anyone even, and also you're right on Ebert's top 10 list, critically beloved, wasn't a movie, and sorry, EP by James L. Brooks, who had won Best Picture for a similarly toned movie. Why wasn't this a movie that was considered?
This is my guess, because I read a handful of reviews that came out at the time. And yes, this movie has 98% of Rotten Tomatoes from critics. But at the time, there were some detractors. And one of the big reviews I read talked about how the film was told from the teenager's perspective. And that there was this not to say that Ordinary People isn't a film about teenagers, but the parents, that's more of like a quote unquote family drama. And I think this film, for good or bad, was sort of defined as a movie about young love, and it was disposable. And I think that adds to it. It comes out in April, which, as we all know, at least in the past, Oscar contenders essentially didn't come out before, you know, December.
It's very zeitgeisty, I guess. Like, it's kind of plugged into like alternative culture.
Yeah. I'm not saying any of these are reasons why it shouldn't have hit, Kenny, in the ways that you're describing, but it does feel to me as though this movie trafficked in a world that felt to an Academy, certainly in 1989, as, you know, too cool for us, or I don't get it, or something.
Yeah, along those lines. No, I mean, that might be true, but I just, you know, I just, the Dick Van Dyke thing
would have been interesting.
It just makes me feel like people were wise to how great this film was before. And then the other thing about it is Dead Poets Society is a teen movie too.
It is
nominated
for
Best Picture, won Best Screenplay, you know, it's a period film, so I guess there's that to it, and there are no women
there's
in it.
The Disney,
so the Academy loves that part, but
thing too, a little bit. There's the Touchstone Disney component, which maybe has something to do with it.
It does just feel, you know. You know,
it's,
what I mean?
I think that had,
because it's excellent,
Cameron Crowe's career been slightly different. Like, I do think that this is the type of movie that got him noticed, put him on the map, and then Singles was just sort of a kind of a shrug. I really like Singles, but I understand why it didn't work for a lot of people. But I want to talk for a quick second about the breakup scene.
Oh,
it's when Lloyd's so like, good. I feel like a dick. She's like, but you're not.
You,
he's like,
you made love
sex
to
with
a dick.
I love that entire scene. Obviously, I gave her my heart. She gave me a pen. Is iconic. It's just unbelievable. Girl made me trust myself. Is amazing.
I was walking 10 feet tall.
And then the rain on my car is a baptism. I mean, all this stuff is just
unbelievable. Or he's like, when you wake up every day depressed, every day is kind of like a pleasant surprise.
Corey, you had it right. When you wake up depressed. Sorry. So I want to talk for a quick second about the boombox scene. Obviously, you know, iconic beyond iconic. It also just feels to me so quintessentially Cameron Crowe. Heart on your sleeve, speaking through music, you know, just this idea of just being the most you can possibly be.
Actually creepy. So like the song
creepy
that you lost your virginity to, and like go to your, you know, the person who dumped you's house and play it just so they can't see you, but
just,
that they'll have
just loud enough so they can hear you.
So they'll wake up and have to remember and hear the song that they lost your virginity to.
I still kind of can't figure out where that car is either, because I was thinking about that too. Like, how is the back of her house like Forrest Gump's house? And the front of the house is like, you know, has a view of the street where you can bow after having a good date. I'm not sure what's going on.
It's funny
there,
you bring that up, because in the article I read, like, obviously shot in two very different locations. So you just really have to just, like, you got to go with it. But
sure.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to go to, you know, my ex's house and just
blast. And just hold up a boombox. I mean, I just it's such a it. I don't know. It's what top three Cameron Crowe moments where you're just like, this is the most Cameron Crowe thing you can do.
Yeah, well, I think it's you know what it is? It's like when you go through a breakup like that, you just want that person to remember that you existed or that what you had was real, right? So it's like, this is lasting proof that I'm like a living organism and we shared this moment together and I'm going to make you remember me even if you're trying to forget me.
But then he calls and says, tear up the letter, burn it.
Oh, yeah.
Right, because he's just like, which is the moment when she picks up the phone and he's not there. But like that
but
is...
But that's kind of the essence of his character.
He's 100%.
Sort of this, like chronic oversharer, like has no filter, can, you know, just a brimming, you know, well of emotions. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so endearing about it. But you're right. He's more masculine because of those feminine traits. And they're so unheard of in like a male leading protagonist, not only in a teen movie, but like in any movie ever, really. He's such an anomaly.
So I want
he's the Pete Davidson of his time.
Yeah, okay. I want to talk about this scene a little more because so there are some people who when say anything comes up will say that movie is problematic and he's creepy and what he's doing is inappropriate. And
how long do you think he played that song for? Like, do you think he played it for like 3 hours?
Three weeks.
He just did it for like 15 minutes. Who knows? I think it's a real
Sopranos finale moment. The rest is it's all in your mind. But I gotta be honest in that part of my goal going into this movie was to disprove that. I really wanted to believe that Lloyd wasn't being a creep. Take no for an answer. And I'll give my little feeling on why he was not a creep who won't take no for an answer.
Okay.
Because, all right, this is maybe a little not the best, but okay.
Oh, boy. It's Patreon.
No. What I want to say is, like, she did break up with him, but she didn't want to break up with him.
That's
like
true.
She wasn't dumping him because she didn't like him or because she didn't want to be with him or because he did something wrong. She was dumping him because her father thought he was a distraction. Yeah. And so it's dicey territory. Mm-hmm. But movies are supposed to deal in this stuff to say sometimes you can read beyond the no and see that there's something more there. Sure. But I think that's what was going on here.
He even asked her, he says, like, you know, is this because of her dad?
Yes. And even when she said no, he later says, I think it's because of her dad. He says that to Corey in DC. And she says, I love you with quotes. And then later says, I love you, no quotes. Like, it's one of the most fucking ambiguous no's or ambiguous breakups you can have because she's so conflicted about it. So I would, my contention is, that like going back at that, first of all, everybody's ever broken up with someone knows the final fucking or that the breakup is not the final communication. Okay. So someone generally doesn't take no for an answer. That doesn't make them a creep. That makes them human. And secondly, like what he does, yeah, it's a little much. It's a little dramatic, but it is also kind of what the moment calls for because he has to appeal to her on a level like different than just, I mean, a letter makes sense, but just a different level because he's dealing with, you know, a guy who at that moment is kind of an emotional terrorist. Like he's kind of an emotional, like John Mulaney's kind of an emotional terrorist at that moment who's winning. And he, you know, so it's a long way of saying like, yeah, I don't know. Like it doesn't look that great in 2022, but like, it's not the like open and shut, like he's a creep moment that I think some people sell it as these days.
Yeah, I've never really bought that narrative, quite frankly, but I understand. I mean, it is what it is. But what were you going to say, Chandler?
Oh, I mean, I guess there's a reading of this film where you think, you know, Diane Cord is being equally emotionally terrorized by both Lloyd and her father, and she's kind of this like chess piece that they're sort of both trying to overtake, and she doesn't know how to really stand up to either of them. So she's kind of this bargaining chip. And I guess that's why she kind of flip-flops so badly. And her dad really, I think she breaks up with him because she just knows that her dad needs her right now. She has to she's so used to giving herself over to her dad and doing everything for her father that she's trying to be there for him in this extreme moment of weakness and stuff for him. So when he says she's a distraction, it's more like Lloyd's a distraction from her relationship with her father.
Yeah.
Well, it's like earlier in the film, there's a moment when there's a couple things. First of all, she's scared to get on a plane. So she does seem to be kind of punting. Maybe I shouldn't go. Maybe I shouldn't go. And she's like, maybe I shouldn't go because of all the stuff you're going through. And he's like, forget that, you're going. Yeah. So I think that she sees an in-between as I'm going to remove Lloyd from the equation so that I can give my father more of my bandwidth, if you will. but I do think there's something to that. When she does get back with Lloyd, Lloyd has a great line.
Such
where he
a
says,
great scene where she comes back after he's
and
been
he gets kicked, oh, in, the, so and kicked in the face. And he says, are you here because you need someone or you need me? Forget it. I don't care.
Yeah. Oh, like, my God.
It's which is, I mean, amazing. And then, of course, she says, like, I want you. I need you. But that to me is so like, that's Lloyd, right? Like, just
exactly.
Like, I so desperately want your love, and I want you to want me, but I'm also so desperate for it that I'll take it, even if it's not. If it's just
and who hasn't been the Lloyd? You know, that's sure. What I think is like so great about his character.
No, totally.
You know,
I love that moment too, and it's. I thought it was, you know, it felt less desperate to me, but more just. More humanistic, like for her, like, it doesn't really matter right now if it's that she wants Lloyd or if she wants someone, because she's here and she chose him, and let's build off this.
So I want to talk about the very last scene on the airplane, a scene that I think of every single time I'm on an airplane, because I too am scared of flying. So I think as soon as the ding happens, everything will be okay. But The Ringer had a really interesting quote that I want to read from this article on Say Anything that came out in 2019 for its anniversary. They said, the obvious cinematic reference point is Dustin Hoffman and Catherine Ross on the back of the bus, having made their great escape in Mike Nichols' The Graduate. But unlike that Clash of Generations and Descent, the last notes here are not anxious or ambivalent, but rather rousing and triumphant. A long shot romance that beats the odds and fled those who would undermine it. A love story that rings as clear and as true as a bell. I obviously agree with that thoroughly, but it is a perfect ending. It is the fact that the ding allows you to believe that it's all going to be okay and that these two are going to make it. You can't ask for anything better than that. Like, just in my opinion, just your two main characters looking just slightly above the camera, not directly into the lens, but just you feel these two wanting so desperately for this to work and then being told that it is going to work. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it is both an open-ended, you know, ending, like, you know, like the feels like almost all high school relationships have an expiry date that kind of eventually happens, you know, after graduation. And
yeah,
of all the, but in some weird way, like, the romance is so well articulated. You feel like if they can survive Diane Court's father, then they are going to make it.
They can,
like,
make it. Yeah.
They can make it all the way. If they survived that, they can survive anything. And, you know, like, it is such a long shot, but, like, even the characters know that. And I don't know, you just believe in them. You believe in them so much.
Yeah.
And sort of like Lloyd has to try so hard to win Diane Court's affections over, you know, and eventually she recognizes his value and, like, lets him in. And him being there for her in that moment is just, and the way that he's talking to her and dictating every single noise in the airplane as it goes off, it's just...
I think it's an interesting replacement
song. The use of Within Your Reach is such a great ending cue, and how the guitars sound like a plane taking off,
and him hitting and his bopping his head to the beat of the drum. It's so good.
I think the counterpoint that was brought up in that quote of The Graduate is really interesting, because, you know, I love The Graduate like everybody else, but sincerity is so much harder than irony. its sincerity is, it's not even fucking close. Because when you're sincere, you open yourself up to mockery. It's so easy to mock someone for being sincere. And when you're ironic, you don't fucking care anyway. You don't even get it. Yeah. You're stupid. Yeah. But no one can say you're stupid if you don't, you know, no one's going to say you're stupid if you don't get a romance. So what I'm trying to say is, this is like high elevated art to make something like this work, to make you want this badly at the end, and to use that as a visual reference, which is what they're doing. They're using that the Graduate thing as a visual reference. It's the same story turned on its head, but the what if is, what if it was about two people who actually loved each other? Could you imagine that?
Yeah.
So, you know,
we're doing it for the right reasons. Yeah.
This was an idea that came about a little later, just a little later, like 5, 6, 7, 8 years later, the idea of the new sincerity.
That's true. Even plastics is referred into this movie.
Sure.
The idea that, you know, old school irony is dead and the cool new thing is sincerity. But in the 80s, we just weren't this sincere, and happy endings came out of nowhere. But this is a sincere movie, and I think that's why it perseveres.
But I think that's sort of central ethos of Cameron Crowe's films, and then also why there was so much backlash towards him as he, that sincerity sort of veered and ebbed and flowed. Yes. And sometimes, like, I think that's what his greatest strength as a filmmaker, and then also maybe his Achilles heel or something.
Well, it's very hard. I
do wonder if part of the thing that got away from him a little was he started doing stuff that he thinks we wanted him to do. I think that when a filmmaker stops doing things because they genuinely want to, and instead it's like a band that gives you a greatest hits record where it's just like, I'm just going to play the hits for you. I think about Elizabethtown in particular. I want to kind of, we're going to talk about our top five in a second, but I do think that,
but we're not going to talk about Elizabethtown, so you can talk about it now.
It's interesting. We are, though. I want to
say all of this is just Cameron Crowe is like my number one favorite filmmaker of all time.
You know
time.
That I and love him too.
The reason I've like done anything creatively in my life.
I went on a podcast and defended Elizabethtown. I literally went on.
I cannot do that.
That's why I am fucking with him.
I know you are. But I'll just say this, that I do think that I just rewatched Vanilla Sky about a week ago. And I've really come around on that movie. I think that movie was.
You love it now.
I do quite like it. Love is a strong word, but there's a lot of stuff.
But when you say come around, you went from hating it to like.
I don't know that I ever hated it, but I definitely didn't love it. I didn't like it. There were a lot of things I didn't like. I imagine that similar to a lot of people when it came out, I think that it just rubbed people the wrong way. And everyone was like, I don't want this from Cameron Crowe. And I think that the boldness and the risk he took in making that, he's kind of crawled back into himself a little bit. And if that film had been received better, and I'm not talking monetarily because it was obviously very successful, but if that film had been, you know, embraced, I'd love to see what that Cameron Crowe career, a bold Cameron Crowe career that goes in different directions and takes risks. And I think that since then, he's like, Elizabethtown is the most reactionary movie I've maybe ever seen of a filmmaker who's like, okay, I'm going to go and make the earnest, you know, Manic Pixie Dream Girl movie now, because that's apparently what you guys want from me. And I think that that's an interesting thing. Yes, Chandler right now is miming the invisible camera that Kirsten Dunst uses in that movie. But yeah, so this is just a long way of saying that his career is fascinating to me, because there's been all these inflection points where you're kind of like, he's had these weird blank checks that he's made interesting choices with, and I don't know that they've all paid off for him.
I don't know. In some ways, I really like Aloha. I know that it's like...
Wow. Have you seen Aloha?
Nope. I told you I've seen 7 of 8. I've never seen that one.
I'll just say this one quick thing about Aloha.
First of all, beautifully shot by like Godard cinematographer.
Yeah, sure. It's a gorgeous,
fucking incredible cinematography.
It is beautiful. And
has
the end
some
scene
earnest, beautiful, ineffable, like,
sure.
I don't know, like almost like French New Wave moments. I know that the casting of Emma Stone is like abysmal and should never be spoken
because she's not Asian. Yes.
She's not a Vietnamese woman.
Correct.
It's extremely weird.
Yeah, it's extremely not okay. Extremely
weird. Or a Hawaiian woman either.
No, of course it's not. Of course it's not okay. But like that rides side saddle to like, what were you thinking?
Yeah, 100%. Like,
100%. What were you thinking? Yeah. That's crazy to me.
It's crazy. I'll say this. I'll ride for one thing about Aloha, which is that, and I said this on Twitter, I met many, many months ago.
Bradley Cooper is a great, you know, part of the canon
of Cameron Crowe male leads, for sure.
Cameron Crowe boys.
The very last scene of the movie is entirely silent and really beautiful and actually makes me cry. Without anything to, I mean, the rest of the movie is not great. You should watch it because the last scene is really beautiful. I don't know that we needed a movie that precedes it necessarily, but that last scene almost makes it worthwhile. That being said,
there are some deep themes that are like in his wheelhouse, like the Rachel McAdams.
Yeah,
romance is kind of interesting. There's a John.
You should watch it, Kenny. You love a messy masterpiece. You love a movie that takes a swing.
There's a fun Bill Murray turn.
But isn't Rachel McAdams like kind of the bad person in this movie?
Yes, correct.
I'm not into, outside of Regina George, I'm not into any Rachel McAdams bashing because she's my favorite.
I hear that.
What about The Family Stone? That's a good movie.
Yeah, everything she's in, she's the best.
So let's rate this. Wait, and then
I want to ask one more question to Cameron Crowe's greatest fan.
Okay.
Where does he go from here?
Good question. I don't know, because I think he made Roadies, right? Which was sort of
But do you know how long ago that was?
Oh,
too long ago.
Six years ago.
And it was not well received. And it is very boring. I tried to watch it. It's really boring. But I love you, Cameron Crowe. If you're listening to this, thank you for everything. There's an Almost Famous musical. So he's sort of like regenerating his pastiche. I don't know if he'll get another chance, to be honest, because in some ways it's not like, I don't know. It'd be really cool if he did like sort of a Paul Schrader, like First Reformed kind of like comeback where he like made a small scale, like A24 movie and something really character driven and just kind of like almost did like a character piece with like a really renowned, interesting actor that he could kind of hone in on like his really impressive flair for just like understanding character and dramatic structure and stuff.
Can I answer the question too?
Yeah, please. Sorry. Of course.
I think I agree with everything that Chandler's saying. The only thing that I would disagree with is I think the Cameron Crowe's he's always going to get a chance. He's too successful to not be given another shot.
But he's writing like Harry Styles profiles for Rolling Stone. Well,
yeah,
like
that I can't speak. But I think there's a book called One Last Thing Before I Go that Jonathan Tropper wrote that is the most perfect Cameron Crowe thing he could do. Mm. There's definitely books or IP or things out there that would give him the cover to be able to get another big thing greenlit and get big stars and have another, you know, another at bat. The question
is, I don't know if we bought a zoo.
And I don't hate We Bought a Zoo, but I know what you're saying. My point is more, is Cameron Crowe, to your point, going to stand up and take a real swing? Yeah. Is he going to be like, I want to be relevant again and I want to figure out a way to hit the zeitgeist? Or is he going to dig in his heels and be like, I know what I'm doing? And if it's that, then I don't necessarily know that there's a tremendous amount of success in it. But I'm curious.
The guy who has done this against all odds, very similar to Cameron Crowe, is M. Night Shyamalan.
Yes.
Who, you know, had three massive hits and then had some embarrassing failures and tried a few different things, tried Last Airbender and tried to do the IP thing, you know, and tried to do a family movie and did a Will Smith movie. And nothing really worked until he stripped it all the fucking way down and pretended like he had no money. And then he built himself back up film by film by film until now he's just doing his old shit again. No pun. And I wonder if that's more than anything, because I think this is kind of what you're talking about, Chandler, with a First Reform, though I would say Paul Schrader never left. He just, you know, he just hit one of these movies. You know, he was he made that movie with Lindsay Lohan, like
The Canyon.
Oh, yeah, The Canyon.
Yeah. It's like he never stopped trying. But Cameron Crowe, to me, just needs to make a movie for $5 million and see what happens.
Yeah, I think he's got to strip it away. Like, I guess maybe I think someone like Mike Mills is kind of his innovator.
Yes, that's a really good call.
Come On, Come On feels kind of like a new age Cameron Crowe movie.
Totally.
But yeah, I mean, I also think that he's gone through so many things, like his divorce with Nancy Wilson and stuff. He should also write like a biography.
I think that you made a really good point, Kenny, about, you know, one of the things that I would argue Cameron Crowe never had to do is he never had skin in the game in the way that M. Night did, right?
Like M. Night decided, or like Francis Ford Coppola, where he like refinances his house.
He needs to do that, to your John point. John Singleton did that. He needs to feel that. The fear a little bit.
John Singleton did that exact thing when he felt like he had lost the fucking plot and he mortgaged his house to do Rosewood, right?
Yep.
So, yes, you're totally right. And you want to know what? Cameron Crowe's at that point. He is probably a 50-something-year-old man. If he wants to keep going, yes, put up your own money and fucking write something that you can shoot like Licorice Pizza and don't let PTA make your movies. Come on, dude. That is your movie.
The only other thing that I would say that he
almost
could
famous
do
his Licorice Pizza.
I know, I'm joking. 100%. He didn't have to make Licorice Pizza, but it's funny that you basically have a movie where PTA is doing almost, you know, a PTA version of a Cameron Crowe movie.
Yes.
And I don't want to see a Cameron Crowe version of a PTA movie. I want to see Cameron Crowe take $5 to $10 million and you do what M. Night did with the grandma movie, you know?
Yeah, The Visit. Yeah. I do wonder the unknowns. Other thing that Cameron Crowe could conceivably do that could be interesting is a biopic of some sort.
He's
a guy.
He should make the Jerry Garcia movie that
Martin Scorsese is making with Jonah Hill. But I do think that that could be the thing that he does, where like he zones in and decides to do like, you know, a Miles Davis movie or whatever it is, like, or the Allman Brothers movie or pick someone from his plethora of people that he interviewed or whatever and decide to like go down that road. I don't know if that's something he does. He's done he's already done a documentary on Pearl Jam.
Oh, so yeah. I forgot about all of his documentaries that he's done. Yeah.
But let's rate this and then let's talk about our favorite Cameron Crowe movies. In 89, as I said, I saw it around 89. I liked it. I wouldn't say that it was my favorite film from the jump. I probably would have given it like a 75 or an 80 at the time.
Wow.
I loved it in the subsequent viewings over the years. Coming into this podcast, I had it at a 93. And after this podcast, I'm at like a 95. I mean, like I have very few flaws in this film now. I think that I saw it too young to really get it. And then it obviously grew on me in the years that followed. But what about you, Kenny?
Well, I was going to give it a 97 before the podcast. And you can't go up much from 97. I'm going to give it a 97. I mean, you know, something's got to be a 97, right?
Sure.
It's best. It's fucking amazing. I mean, it's not Major League, but it's an incredible film. So
Major League.
But what
about
is?
You, Chandler?
I mean, I think I'm at 100. I mean, I feel like I imprinted on it psychologically, romantically. Yeah, sure, it was like the entire benchmark of like how I've viewed romantic relationships for better and most definitely for worse. And, you know, I think it's interesting because I've always actually felt like the Lloyd Dobler, never the Diane Court. So for me, I've actually like, I don't know. I think I actually see myself more in Lloyd than I ever have as Diane. And Diane has always felt foreign to me. I've always been
interesting.
Like, and I think that's how I've viewed relationships. Like I always feel like the Lloyd. And I don't know. It's just like, yeah, this movie, I think the sincerity of it and the human drama of it and its adultness is what's so compelling to me about it. It's just a perfect film.
It's also
not even just a perfect teen movie or perfect rom-com, which are like two genres or coming age movies that are all maligned genres. It's just like a very excellent screenplay and film.
It's hard to do earnest. It's so hard to do, as I'm sure we all know. It's so hard. And when you do it well, it's brilliant. I'll start. My number five is Elizabethtown. You can just listen to my episode of This Had Oscar Buzz to hear me defend it valiantly, even if I probably fail. But I don't know. I just, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't work. A litany of things that don't work, but there's a lot of things that I actually really love. And I'm a sucker for Kirsten Dunst in that movie. So take that for what it's worth. What's your number five, Kenny?
Vanilla Sky, okay. Which I like, which I don't love. Which I've wanted to love for a long time, which, sure. You know, but it's not as bad as it could have been. Mm-hmm. This is very clearly out of his wheelhouse. It feels like it's a wheelhouse he wants to play in, but it's kind of a waste of everyone's time. That being said, like, I think about the movie all the time. Like, yeah. It really has become, you know, a bit of a touchstone for me. And there's some good shit in there. It's a good movie. Yeah.
But we'll see each other in another life when we're both cats.
Yes, when we're both cats.
Chandler, what's your five?
Aloha.
Something had to be five.
Cameron Crowe really hasn't made that many movies, considering.
I know, that's the thing.
He only made eight. I know.
He only made eight. So it's, as I said to Kenny when we texted back and forth about whether we should do the top five, I was like, it's worth it for the rankings, as far as I'm concerned. It's less about what the movies are. I imagine that our top
We're not including Fast Time, right?
No.
If I did include Fast Times,
okay,
it would not be number five.
Interesting.
It would be higher than his good four movies without a question.
Okay. Well, my number four.
I don't like singles. I actually hate singles.
Oh, that might make list. Okay,
that's interesting. Vanilla Sky is my number four. We talked about it a little bit earlier.
Not going to make either of your list, I guess.
I don't know.
Are you missing something, Phil?
I might be. I don't think so, but maybe.
If singles is on your list, then you are missing one of the three actual masterpieces. So what's happening?
Okay.
Am I wrong, Chandler?
What?
We'll see. We'll see.
I think that Vanilla Sky is a really interesting movie that I mentioned earlier. I've watched relatively recently. Kenny also alluded to the fact that we are going to cover Obrelas Oros.
Paper on comparing Vanilla Sky to Aubrey Lesojus.
Well, then you should come on for that episode. That
sci-fi would make the most sense. class I took in university, and they gave me like a C, deservedly so.
You should come on and tell us all about the two films. But yeah. My point more than anything is, I agree it's outside his wheelhouse. That's kind of why I like it. Kenny and I have talked about messy masterpieces before, movies where directors try things that don't really work. Obviously, we're both big fans of Blank Check. I think Vanilla Sky is a blank check movie. And I think a lot of it is a mess, but a lot of it is really interesting. And that's my number four.
It's pretty good. Yeah. Singles is my four.
Okay.
Ooh. Singles is a good movie. Singles is a fine movie. Singles is... all right. Well, I'll tell you what I really like about
Singles. Yeah.
It's the only movie that I can remember ever presenting grunge music as the culture and not a subculture.
Yeah.
Which it was.
That's interesting.
It was culture at beyond Seattle. It just happens to take place in Seattle. But but yuppie nerds like Campbell Scott used to go to those type of shows, just like people now go to fucking, you know, Kanye shows. Because it was the culture, and that's just an interesting moment in time. And I love that about it. I think there's so many things about that movie that's just like dumb and so many things that are regressive. And I don't think it's like a great romance. And I think it paints women in a weird light. And, but I think that like the vibe of that movie is fucking awesome. Mm-hmm. And it's a travesty that more movies didn't highlight grunge as something beyond, you know, kind of like angry teen music, because it's really not what it was. So
totally. What's your four, Chandler?
Yeah. Well, I don't like Singles because I find the characters really hateful. Like, I find that it's a really aromantic movie and the sort of vying for relationships. And you're right, the kind of like bland waspiness of like those mm-hmm. two leads. It's like, can't sink my teeth into that. I mean, I agree with what you're saying about its love of grunge culture and the music and the soundtrack and sort of how the way that he's his meaningful connection to those bands and his relationship with Pearl Jam and stuff. But I don't think it's like a romance the way that like his other films are. Mine's also Vanilla Sky. I think that the like Rolling Stoneification of the way that he's playing with like pop culture and media of the time, and the opening with the emptied out Times Square set to the Radiohead song, and Tom Cruise's performance, and like the way that he recontextualizes like the Bob Dylan covers, and you know Penelope Cruz as Audrey Hepburn. It's like
so Audrey Hepburn. It's crazy.
It's really really cool. Like the way that he's playing with pop culture, and yeah, it doesn't all work, but. I also love like Ambitious Failures. And
same.
Yeah.
I think too. That I'd rather see a Cameron Crowe taking a lot of risks than like a complacent Cameron Crowe, you know, playing into his wheelhouse and playing it safe.
Yeah, I totally agree. And one other thing that I want to say about about Vanilla Sky is, you know, it's the last time that Tom Cruise, and some might argue this was unsuccessful in this film, but in Vanilla Sky, but like Tom Cruise as fuckboy, Tom Cruise as like, you know, sexy romantic lead that you might actually buy in the, that's the last gasp, because everything after that is sort of like, he can never get it back.
And Cameron Diaz's performance is, I think, one of the most brave and
it's
terrifying and like committed things I've ever seen her do.
Yeah.
Like that accident.
There's a lot of good shit in that movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good shit. The car off the bridge in Central Park.
It's harrowing.
That's good shit. Like there is. That's part of why this movie bothers me, is because the good shit is really good and the bad shit is really mailed in. Like the end is really mailed in. The stuff Kurt Russell's
stuff doesn't work at all.
It's
like when they're kind of in that rooftop that kind of looks like the rooftop from The Room.
right. Yeah, you think someone's going to throw a football. You never know.
It's definitely, because it's interesting, because Cameron Crowe is not one to use special effects. So this movie attempts to do that. And you're just like, this isn't yours. So my number three, Singles. I'm going to defend it very briefly and just say that it's the only Cameron Crowe film I think that actually could be a television show. It's the one.
Oh, sure.
It has that Melrose Placey kind of vibe to it that I think really works to its benefit. I agree 100% with you, Chandler, that like the characters are not nearly deep enough. It's him trying to do the 20-something experience, and I don't know that he actually really taps into it particularly well.
Yeah, it's like this complaints about dating that just feel like how people talk about like Hinge these days.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird movie that doesn't totally work, but the stuff that does work, I do quite like.
And I like the video dating stuff a lot. Another thing,
Tim Burton cameo.
Another thing that people pretend like that wasn't a thing. That was a thing.
Yes.
It's
also a very white movie. It's
very
like a painfully white movie.
Well, you know, I don't know. I think I think tokenism is kind of worse than not.
I think
Campbell Scott's character is half Vietnamese, so.
I think it's just a quarter, but he's a Vietnamese name.
I think it's a failing to some degree of Cameron Crowe's that he doesn't dig a little bit deeper in terms of just subcultures and just cultures in general. But that's
you're forgetting Xavier McDaniel. But
I am. What's your three, Kenny?
The movie that I guess you don't have on your list, Almost Famous.
He's saving that for number one.
Yeah.
Wait a second. What's happening? You have three more left, right?
Two.
Sorry, you have two more left, right?
Two more left.
Yeah, but then are you missing Jerry Maguire? No. That doesn't make any sense.
Are you missing Say Anything?
Say Anything's not on your list.
Oh my God, I completely forgot Say Anything.
What?
That's my mistake. I completely forgot.
I knew it. The whole list made no sense.
You're absolutely right. On your list. You're gonna put.
I completely forgot if I say anything, guys.
It was just outside my brain.
You do your number three, Kenny. My number. Things are gonna change. Continue.
Things are gonna change. I just figured.
I'm bumping Elizabethtown.
Yeah.
So that is not. It's Vanilla Sky. Wow. Singles at four. My three would be Say Anything.
Two would be Singles. Oh, Singles
two
is
would
four.
Be Jerry Maguire.
Three.
And one
all right,
is,
well, okay. All right, so I'll give you my top three because you just gave me yours.
Well, we'll
my top three yeah, we'll talk about is, my top three is every one of the world's top three.
Yeah.
In some order, mine is sure. Almost Famous, Jerry Maguire, Say Anything. Yep. Three perfect movies.
Yep. Yep.
Probably only ranked that way because that's the order I saw them, and therefore I have more love saved up for Saved Anything. Then sure, Jerry Maguire. Sure. I also think Say Anything is the best movie of the three. I think Jerry Maguire is the second best movie of the three. And you know, and I think Almost Famous is, I think Say Anything is the best movie. Jerry Maguire is the most fun experience. And Almost Famous is number two on both of those lists. So they're three incredible films. I love them all.
Yep.
99s all around. But that's my order.
What is your top three, Chandler? And then we can just kind of talk
about
the movies.
Okay, number one, Almost Famous. Greatest mm-hmm. movie ever made.
See, this is why Chandler and I get along so well.
I'm saying that facetiously, but I actually mean that like as a...
No, I know,
like,
in your heart.
The way that my bones are made of calcium deposits.
Okay, your number two?
Say Anything.
And then Jerry Maguire at number three?
And then Jerry Maguire at number three, yeah. But
my number one is Almost Famous, then Jerry Maguire, then Say Anything. But yeah, what were you saying? Sorry, Joe.
Oh, like Kenny, they're just a trifecta of
perfect,
entertaining, heartwarming, you know, surprising, endlessly satisfying films to watch.
All incredible films. It's just, I guess the reason Almost Famous is three for me, if I really break it down,
yeah,
is because I watched it when I was already kind of a nerd and like a film nerd.
Sure.
And it just, any ability to watch a movie without also analyzing it in the moment mm-hmm. kind of left my body around 99 into 2000. Mm-hmm. Right. So everything post 2000 almost had to hit me on a different kind of metatextual level.
Sure.
And that's my fault. But that's the only reason I can think of, because I think it's amazing. I love Almost Famous.
Yeah, I mean, Almost Famous is one of those movies that it is a bomb. Whenever I'm feeling down or whenever it just makes me feel good. It's so familial. It feels like you're part of a part of a community. You're part mm-hmm. of you just feel so welcomed into this rock and roll family. It's perfect. I mean, Jerry Maguire is another film that just works on so many levels that it's crazy to me. The end of that movie makes me cry every time. Rod on whatever the name of that television show is, when he finds out that he got the money and he tells Jerry that he's his ambassador of Quant. Like, it's just like stuff like that. You're just like, yeah, you put that on paper, you're like, how could you possibly execute this?
You're not going to make me cry.
You know what I mean? Your brother was injured in a freak bass fishing accident. Like stuff that this just shouldn't fucking work.
The human head weighs 9 pounds.
I do think that that's Cameron Crowe's superpower, to come full circle on this thing, is just the superpower of understanding that he knows how to execute dialogue that other mm-hmm. people just couldn't do. And, you know, you just got to throw your hands up and just say, like, yeah, that's why he's one of the masters.
Well, I think it does come from being a journalist, right? Because I think,
listening to
people, transcribing conversations, you know, carving out a 4-hour conversation you had with someone to like the perfect quote that distills exactly what they're going through and what's happening in their life. I mean, Those are like fine honed skills.
And being a little super genius who graduates at 15, which is what he was. Helps. He also is like this little absolutely super genius who likes our nerd shit. And I wish I do wish there were more that brand of nerds, the music, film, you know, TV, pop culture nerds that we used to get, as opposed to everybody being a fucking Marvel nerd. But at least we got,
I agree with you, at least we got
No Way Home out of it. So it could have been worse.
the most recent Spider-Man movie, because Chandler looks completely confused as to what just transpired.
I literally don't know.
He's one of my favorite filmmakers. His films are endlessly watchable to me. I hope that he finds his fastball again. I think we all do. But more than anything, Chandler, thank you so much for coming on and talking.
Thank you, Chandler. Oh, my feelings are even more warm.
More warmth.
You could say anything to me, Chandler.
Oh. And don't you get ready.
Yeah.
He has this great book of conversations with Billy Wilder that I encourage any Cameron Crowe completionist to...
Or writer in general.
Yeah, it's kind of like his version of Hitchcock Truffaut, and they talk about his whole filmography, and it's just amazing.
It is truly special.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because you kind of see these like generational parallels and like someone like Cameron Crowe being influenced by someone like Billy Wilder, and in some ways, like Say Anything is this kind of textbook mumblecore film for sort of this new generation of teen movies. You could say a show like Sex Education is like inherited by it. But I wonder if there is going to be kind of a generation of filmmakers my age. Like, I always feel a bit ersatz when I say that like Cameron Crowe is my like generational or like my most influential filmmaker.
Sure.
Whereas like other people are like probably saying like the Dardenne brothers or something. but it's just like he's so fucking good.
He is, and I also second Chandler in, if you can find that book, which is out of print now, unfortunately,
it's very hard to find.
If you can find the Cameron Crowe Billy Wilder book, I highly recommend checking it out. And honestly, I hope that you'll come back and talk about Vanilla Sky and Orlis Oros, however it is pronounced, with us because you're our Cameron Crowe expert, so that's what needs to happen.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for having me on. It was a true delight and an honor, and stay safe. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it.
Podcast like it's 1989. Baby fish mouth. Ethel Baby Mammoth. Fish mouth.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.